Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Marie Benedict is a former lawyer who's written 10 novels. Her latest book, The Only Woman in the Room, is a work of historical fiction about the actress from the golden age of Hollywood, Hedy Lamarr. In addition to her acting career, Hedy was also an inventor. In the 1940s, she created a radio guidance system that eventually led to the development of Bluetooth and Wi-Fi technology. Marie Benedict talks this hour with journalist and director of arts and culture for the City of Detroit, Rochelle Riley. Rochelle asked Marie to explain why some of her books are written under the name Marie Benedict and others as Heather Terrell.
So, yes, I am Heather Terrell, and I'm also Marie Benedict. And my real name, but don't tell anybody, because I'll obviously have to kill you afterwards, is Heather Marie Benedict Terrell. So, I was a lawyer for a long, long time. And I think I mentioned backstage, it was over 10 years, but that's dog years. So that's like 70 years, maybe more. I'm not sure how to calculate that. But anyway, math is not my strong suit. It was a really long time. And when I first started writing, I wrote 7 books under the name Heather Terrell. They explored the themes that still kind of inhabit me today, themes about history and hidden voices within history, but they didn't focus in specifically on women, and they didn't focus in specifically on the genre of historical fiction, using that very intimate I voice, bringing that story really intimately forward. And when I started with the first in the thematically connected series of books, starting with The Other Einstein, and then Carnegie's Maid, and The Only Woman in the Room, it was requested or suggested or inquired as to whether or not I had any interest in using a pen name, and because it really signaled a change in genre, a change in my focus. And I couldn't really answer to like Isabella, because that's a beautiful name, but it has nothing to do with me. So I kind of went with something that was very specific to me, and I became Marie Benedict. But you guys can call me whatever you want, really. Heather, Marie, I answered anything.
Well, I love the name Marie Benedict, and it fit with this book. So I want to talk about, now we're talking an art history and history major in Boston, of all places. Love Boston.
But me too.
I never see you as a Bostonian now that we've gotten to know each other. I don't know what that means, except you just don't look Bostonian.
Okay, I'll take it.
But I want you to talk a little bit more about a sea change, because for women, mm-hmm. you know, I just did that.
Huge change.
You talk about dog years. When you're a journalist, it's like German Shepherd years. but to leave a newsroom and to go and do something else is really stirring. So when you,
right.
you were a real like attorney, you were somebody who was actually doing God's work and then decided.
I wouldn't call it God's work.
Well, you got to call it something.
Possibly the devil's.
Weren't you praying to
know.
God all the time while this was going
on?
But so that's a big jump. I want you to go back to the moment that you decided, okay, I've had enough of the law, or I've done what I can accomplish mm-hmm. in the law, and I'm going to do something totally different.
Totally different. Well, wow. How long do we have today here, guys? You guys want to be here for about 6 or 7 hours. I'm going to connect 2 seemingly disparate events, right? And it's between those 2 disparate events that the metamorphosis occurred. So I had, and there'll be some wonderful students I spoke with today who have heard a little bit of this, but I had a wonderful aunt who was an English professor growing up, and she gave me a book that was the first pivotal event. She gave me this book, The Mists of Avalon. Has anyone here read it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we got applause. That's pretty sweet. So for those of you who don't know it, it is for its time, it was groundbreaking. It's a female-centric retelling of the Arthurian legends. King, you know, Arthur, Lancelot, Knights of the Round Table, but from the perspective of the women. And this was when I was in middle school, and it was really not done at that time, these type of stories. And it opened up my eyes to really the idea that there are so many hidden voices in the past, so many untold stories out there for me to discover. And it started me on the path of becoming what I thought was going to be a historian. That was my major. And if you were a history major, when I was a history major, everyone asked you when you were going to law school, you know? So I ended up going on that path and kind of got deterred by those societal voices kind of pushing me in that direction. And it took me a while, but I knew that that wasn't what I was called to do. And a dear friend of mine asked me a question. She asked when I was practicing law. She said, would there ever be a client I would refuse to represent on moral grounds, even though my client had a strong legal position? And I didn't have an answer to that question, but in the days that followed, the very first few cases in which families of Holocaust victims were seeking the recovery of artwork stolen from their families, from museums and collectors and art auction houses, started to surface. And as I delved into those cases, I realized I had an answer to my friend's question. If I had been asked to be involved in one of those cases, I would be representing the museum. I represented big clients. And I would be advocating against the family of Holocaust victims, and the law would be in my favor. But morally, I couldn't do it. And that moment kind of set me back to where I started, back with the Mists of Avalon, back when I was in middle school, because I realized I had a story. I'd never thought I would be a writer. I was just a reader and a lover of history. I knew in that moment that I had to excavate that story from the past and give voice to that little piece of history, which at that time really, really hadn't been told. And that was my very first book, The Chrysalis.
Wow.
Was that too long? I'm really sorry.
Not
that
at
was
all.
Long-winded.
Not at all.
I go on.
So here's the other decision that one has to make, particularly when you're a historian and you are digging, like reporters do, to find facts. When I got your book, I had not been as excited about a book since Ahab's Wife.
Ooh.
Except Ahab's Wife is like Mists of Avalon, where it's the other person that you don't get to know. Ahab's Wife is about the woman who was left on the shore. Well, you know the Moby Dick story. So this was not that, because what you're doing is taking a real character, Hedy Lamarr, and I'm sad to say I'm old enough to remember as a child seeing those old movies. You know, I watched the Bob Hope, Bing Crosby movies, and we used to have a projector that you could rent from the library in my little hometown, so I could watch
amazing.
The gay divorcee on the film. Who remembers film reels?
I do.
Please raise your hand. Okay, there we go.
Get your hands up, people.
But I was a kid who used to go to the library and rent that projector and watch all of the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies on the reel. So this was so different for me because this is a real person that you have fictionalized. I want you to talk about the decision to take this woman, Hedy Lamarr, whose story is so amazing, and give her voice. As soon as I started reading it, it was in first person. I was like, how does she know Hedy Lamarr? She's dead. And I went, oh, wait, that's not it.
Yeah.
Why first person and why fictionalized?
Why fictionalized? Well, those are two slightly different but related questions.
Both, right, two questions at once.
I think, you know, first of all, the decision to write in the first person, I can't answer that other than saying it's the only way I can really get into their headspace, my characters, the women that I write about. You know, my research process is pretty elaborate, like Doug mentioned, it's a deep dive. And if I can get my hands on original source material, written letters, journals, written in that eye, I feel like I found my character. And with almost every woman that I've written about, I've been able to make that connection and had some sort of original source material in which they spoke in that voice. And for me to feel that kind of connection and that kind of intimate look into their lives, I think of them as I. When I write them as she, suddenly they're removed from me, and suddenly I don't feel that kind of union with them and that ability to tell their stories.
So you're becoming that woman.
I'm channeling, actually, yes. No, really not. I mean, I'm obviously not Hedy Lamarr, though I wish I was. And to answer your question about...
Well, before you go to that question, because you have been channeling, almost, and because you are gorgeous, regardless of what you think...
Oh, right.
I want you to read just a little bit of... There were several passages that brought me to tears, but there were some powerful chapters, and whose phone is that?
That, you know what? We're going to learn tonight that Hedy is responsible for Wi-Fi, and I feel like that's her calling, telling you to turn off your cell phone.
Hedy, we're on it.
All right. Really, I don't care.
I want you to read a passage now that you've talked about her voice so that people can hear her voice through you.
I will do this, but I will say that Rochelle has picked out the one with the most foreign words. So just pretend like I know how to pronounce these. Okay. The sole aspect of the wedding planning in which I involved myself was the guest list. Fritz insisted on inviting not only high society, such as Prince Gustav of Denmark, but also key political leaders, including Chancellor Engelbert Dollfuss and Kurt von Schuschnigg. See what I said? I mean, really. My requests were few. I only wanted to include 5 or 6 theater friends of my own and some of Papa and Mama's families, but Fritz had balked. He was worried about the numbers. Fritz had decided upon the Grand Hotel of Vienna on Kürtnerring for the wedding luncheon, and it would only accommodate 200 people. With Fritz's guests alone, we were nearing that number. As we walked, I asked about an invitation for my theater mentor, Max Reinhardt, an important director and producer in his own right, when Fritz interrupted me with a non sequitur. What do you think of Karlskirche? Are you familiar with it? Why was he asking me about one of the most famous buildings in Vienna, the fantastical Baroque church with its vast copper cupola flanked by 2 columns? What on earth did it have to do with my request to add Max to the guest list? Was it larger than some of the other venues he was considering? And anyway, it was a Christian church. Of course, Fritz, I worked hard to keep the annoyance out of my voice in the hopes that he'd expand our guest list. No one could live in Vienna and be unfamiliar with the Karlskirche. It dominates our skyline. I shook my head a little and then, after a brief pause, continued discussing the guest list. Are you sure we don't have space for Max? And what about my aunt and uncle? Papa would be so disappointed not to have his brother at the wedding. Hetty, I didn't ask you about the Karlskirche as a way of making general conversation. I wondered whether you would like to get married there, he snapped. Me? Married in the Karlskirche? Was it possible that Fritz didn't know that my family heritage was Jewish? We'd never discuss religion, not his or mine, not once. I just assumed, as Papa had pointed out, because I hailed from Döbling, he would know. I'm not a Christian, Fritz, I said carefully, and even though I'm not religious, my family background is Jewish. His expression didn't change. I surmised that, Hetty. But that shouldn't stop us from marrying in the Karlskirche. My own father converted from Judaism to Catholicism simply so he could marry my mother. I can arrange for a quick conversion for you so we can be married there. He made the suggestion lightly, as if switching from Jewish to Christian was a matter as easy and uncontroversial as changing a dinner order from fish to beef. I had never heard him speak about his own family's religious history, and I was surprised to hear that he had Jewish ancestry as well. Conversion? My family wasn't religious, but conversion was a drastic step. What would Papa say? I knew how scared he was for me and our family in the anti-Semitic political climate, and how badly he wanted this marriage to proceed as a means of protection. But would that condone this measure? Perhaps we could reach an accord without the necessity for conversion. I chose my words with care. Is there no other place that you'd like us to marry? One of your homes? What about Schloss Schwarzenau? Or your apartment in Vienna? His eyes narrowed and his jaw clenched in a way I'd only ever seen when he spoke to those nameless business acquaintances who paid their respects at restaurants or when I mentioned his upbringing. The Karlskirche is the place where society folk marry, and I intend to have our wedding celebrated properly. Besides, it won't do for me to have a Jewish wife, not with the sort of business I'll be conducting in the months to come. He nodded, as if reaching a conclusion. Yes, the more I think about it, the more certain I am that we should have a Christian ceremony at the Karlskirche. I slowed my gait. Papa wanted the security that this marriage could provide, and now the marriage required conversion. What other path could I take without putting my family or myself at risk? Besides, I told myself, my tie to religious heritage was tenuous at best. My Jewishness had always been the vaguest of shadows, and a conversion wouldn't preclude acknowledgement of that. I was too far down this road to veer off it now. Giving Fritz's arm a squeeze, I quickened my step to match his stride. Trying to keep my voice light and merry, I said, "Of course, the Karlskirche it is."
Wow. So I read that passage and I was transported to the 1930s, which would have been very different for me. But also thinking about a woman who's one of the smartest women, period. And that is literally what life is like, even when it's a woman of means who's marrying a very wealthy, very horrible man. And so the other decision that I wanted to ask about was how did you decide to make sure people understood that there was strength underneath her while she was also doing something as simple as bowing to the every wish of a monster?
Right. Right. I mean, that's a great question. I think writing in that first person and giving her internal dialogue as well as her external dialogue allows the readers in on Hetty's little secret that you can be beautiful and brilliant, even though her times didn't believe that, and that was one of the greatest impediments of her life. She described her beauty as a mask she could never take off, a mask she could not remove. And, you know, even when she tried to show people a glimmer of what kind of lay beneath that mask, nobody wanted to see it. They wanted her to put that mask back on. So the best way for me to really show the reader all that brilliance and all that doubt and all that strength that really, really is just bubbling to the surface, but she has to suppress because her time simply won't allow it, is to show you what she's thinking. And that is one of the reasons why I love historical fiction as opposed to nonfiction. You know, it really allows me the opportunity to go places that you can't go in nonfiction, especially in character studies like this. I can hopefully kind of give the reader a window into what she may have been thinking, what she may have been considering or plotting or planning, or, you know, the real truth beneath the acquiescence that you see in her actions.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Marie Benedict talks about how she fills in the gaps when history hasn't recorded the lives of the women she writes about.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Rochelle Riley's conversation with novelist Marie Benedict.
Now, I can tell you that had I been someone who had some greater sense of history and tried to do something like this as a reporter, you know, we're looking for the lead. We're looking for the headlines. Like, oh my God, Hedy Lamarr, Wi-Fi, GPS. That would have been the story. Your decision was to introduce her to people as a woman, as someone who had to go through all the things she did. And, oh, by the way, she also was brilliant and did these things. Can you talk a little bit about the decision you made for the book to be what it was, but how you introduced that she also had a chance to partner on these amazing things that we use every day.
Right. I mean, I think for me, whether it's this particular book about Hedy Lamarr or in The Other Einstein, the story of Albert Einstein's first wife, who was also a physicist and kind of explores the idea that she may have played a real role in his theories, I kind of see the characters, my women, who were real women, I see them as heroes, you know? And their superpower, for lack of a better word, is really that contribution, that whether it's in Hedy's case, this incredible invention, in the case of Mileva Merrick Einstein, it was the theory of relativity. It's really this epiphanal moment, this enormous contribution that they make. And I'm interested in this, their origin story, almost like their superpower. Heroes. I want to know how they got there, what events led up to that moment, that critical moment in which this woman has made something or contributed something, the legacy of which we are all benefiting from today, but we're unaware of their contribution. So in order to get to that moment, I kind of look backwards and say, when did it start? When was the beginning of the path that put Hedy Lamarr in this unique position of creating this amazing invention, which definitely didn't have the purpose of powering your cell phone over there or, you know, anybody else who wants to have their phone ring. You know, it's that wasn't her purpose. Her purpose was really to create a secret communication system that would fight the Nazis. And then it took so many iterations after that to ultimately become Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. But what happened to her that led to that moment, that led to that epiphanal moment. And that's kind of where the story begins. I look for that start.
That's the thing that drew me and reminded me of Hidden Figures and Katherine Johnson, who literally went to work for, not initially with NASA, but for aeronautical folks because she needed a job. She literally was working at a time where she was one of the smartest people in the state of Virginia, but needed a job. And then she wound up being somebody who literally Neil Armstrong wanted her permission for him to decide, okay, she has to make sure that this orbit is going to work. So that part was so lovely and just meticulously drawn in the book so that it wasn't a science book and it wasn't totally sort of a literary biography. It was both. So that leads to the next decision. When you are writing about women who have horrible men in their lives and who also have men who are not so horrible, sometimes just stupid.
Right. or a product of their times.
How do you decide how much of the characters who aren't your main character are a part of the book? Because when it's someone as horrible as Fritz, you have to make sure that the reader knows who they are, and you have to put enough in there so that they can actually, abhor them. But how do you make the decision? Does that sound too harsh?
No, you need to know that, right? Yeah.
So how do you make the decision about the supplemental characters so that she is still the star? Because she was a star anyway, and we're going to talk a little bit about, how many people know the story of Hedy Lamarr anyway, even before the book? I know there are people who, come on, you can clap. Hedy Lamarr, who doesn't want to be, did you notice how I immediately did Hedy Lamarr?
We're not going to talk about that.
I won't say anything else about that, but how do you decide how to make sure that she remains the star while you're trying to make sure people, because it's such a brilliant thing that everybody can't do. Talk about the supplemental characters.
Well, certainly in Hedy's case, the fact of her marriage to Fritz Mandl, for those of you who don't know, at the beginning of the book, she starts out with a really potentially successful fledgling acting career, and she is pursued by Fritz Mandl, who at the time is the richest man in Austria. He derives his wealth from munitions manufacturing, and the political climate being what it is, post-World War I, you have Austria at the center of all these fascist regimes on the rise, Mussolini to the south, Nazi Germany to the north. He's desperate. He's working with politicians to maintain Austria's independence, but ultimately becomes an arms dealer to Mussolini and Hitler, right? And he, she is in the path of this monstrous person, not just because of his nickname, the Merchant of Death, because he deals in arms, but because he's an abuser, verbal, physical, he's controlling. The intersection of their paths is absolutely critical for her privy to all the information that leads to that led to World War II, all the secret plans that Hitler and Mussolini had, whether it was military or in the case of the Holocaust, and also all her knowledge about weapon system, because those secrets are what she utilized to make the secret communication system that ultimately became Wi-Fi, right? So it's critical to really explore that relationship. But as you mentioned, to really maintain her strength and her independence amidst that. And the way that I chose to do it in this case was to show enough of his monstrosity, but also to show his allure, right? I mean, he wasn't a monster when she married him, or at least as far as she thought. He became a monster in stages as his true nature was revealed in a situation in which the political dynamic is becoming heightened, and his stress and his nerves and his fears are becoming heightened as well. So it happens in stages, not all at once, which is sort of one way to show how she maintains her strength. And then as his abuse and control reaches a fever pitch, her escape necessarily occurs at that point. But there's certainly a lot of anecdotes and stories that I had heard, that I had read, that I chose not to include because I felt as though it would tip the balance against, it would make her so unsympathetic, him so overpowering, and her desire to stay in the situation, even though she often didn't have a choice, would make her not as sympathetic as a character. So there is a fine line you walk in making those choices. And I made those same decisions in The Other Einstein as well. How much of Albert Einstein's very unpleasant treatment of his first wife, Mileva, should I show, despite the fact that I'd heard many, many anecdotes beyond what I included in the story? So it's enough to show the really horrific situation in which they'd been living, but not too much.
So next decision is this path that you've created where you now have this series of books. Marie Benedict has this series of books.
Aunt Heather, kind
Aunt
of?
Heather.
I don't know.
Heather Marie Benedict,
there
Terrell.
We go. We'll go with that.
Where you're letting people know about all of these. So every time you mention The Other Einstein, I think about the wife and how Glenn Close was robbed of an Oscar.
Oh my gosh, absolutely.
Yes.
If you
yes.
want to applaud for that, you may.
Yes, she was robbed.
She was. That's a phenomenal.
And for anybody who didn't see the movie, she was the wife of this amazing writer who wasn't an amazing writer because she was doing all the writing.
Right.
And he won a Nobel Prize. But you have started something that's an amazing all your own genre of books where you're doing this for these women, where you are literally reintroducing them to the world. Even if it's historically fictionalized, it's still history, and
yeah.
there are still these people. How did you decide to do that? What made you decide to do that?
Well, I mean, there certainly were times as I was jumping into each one of these projects that I almost didn't do it because of the nature of the people who were involved. You know, the first one in the series, of course, is The Other Einstein, and I almost didn't write that book because, you know, Albert Einstein is such an iconic figure, and people are so wedded to this very specific notion of the wild-haired genius, benevolent, which is not who he was. He was a great scientist, but he was not a great man, at least in my opinion. And so I almost didn't do that, you know? And what I tried, at least in that book, and it's a little different here, was I felt strong enough about telling her story. I felt that her life, you know, she made this meteoric rise from the backwater of 19th century Serbia to become one of the very first women to be a physics student at a university. Her story deserved to be told, right? So I decided that I would take that plunge despite the way people might feel about him. And with Hedy Lamarr, it was similar, even though there, you know, in her case, people have certain preconceptions about who she was and who, whether it was in her romantic relationships or who she portrayed on screen. I felt again so strongly about people learning the truth, my version of the truth, right, my fictional story, learning this other part of who she was, which in many ways was a legacy far more important than the movies for when she was once much more famous. I really felt that I should overcome my hesitation to write stories about women and other characters who were otherwise very well known. You know, I really feel, you know, if I do my job right at the end of the day and people read these stories, which I'm so thankful that they do, then hopefully they'll have sort of a fresh lens with which not just to look at our past, but also our present, you know, to see these women that are really hiding in plain sight all around us, these devices we use, these contributions they've made, these movements that they've started that we have absolutely no idea are really attributable to all these historical women. So if I do my job right, we can start to see them and not just rewrite them back into books, but actually see them in the world that we inhabit. And then we won't not see them in the future, right? It's almost like we have to relearn and put on these fresh lenses to actually see them where they already are. So if I do my job right, then I take the risk about writing about these women, then it's worth that discomfort that I feel sometimes.
Well, you did your job right, and I do like the idea of a fresh lens, because we can all use those every now and again.
Oh my gosh, me too.
So anyway, I was watching Jurassic Park last week.
A non sequitur, sorry.
For the fifth time, maybe the 15th over time, but the fifth time just recently in the past year. And there's a beginning sequence in this very popular Steven Spielberg movie where they're explaining how they were able to create a dinosaur. And it's because they get the dino DNA and then they have to fill in these gaps. So I want you to talk about the decision about which things had to be historically accurate and which things you took a little liberty with because you needed it for the tale. and how you decide which is which.
Well, I'm going to digress just for a quick minute.
Please.
Just to talk, just for a second, not too much, I don't want to bore you, just about how I do the research, what the process
yes,
looks
let's
like
do that,
a little bit.
Yes, let's do that, because I was going to ask about archival first, but then I got excited about Jurassic Park.
Well, so. I understand.
So let's
the
do archival
analogy
first.
Is clear. The analogy is clear. I think, you know, for me, the research, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, starts really with that original source material, if I can find it. The hurdle that you always face in writing about historical women is that it's only recently that women's stories and women's documents and their research has been considered worthy of keeping. So when you're going back into the past and you're looking for documents that you might otherwise assume would be available for someone of that time period and class and aren't necessarily available for women. So let's put that on the side, because that really plays into that line between fact and fiction. So when I can get my hands on original source material, which are things written at the time, in the person's hand, or by a contemporary, that's like the gold standard. That's what I want, right? I want to find things that will help me really inhabit that character's voice and mind and perception, and really give me wonderful insights. And then I'm going to layer in the rest of the research. I'm going to look at whatever I can find about the socio-political world, the cultural developments, their clothes, the food that they eat. I've got to not only create a world that really makes sense, that's very realistic, but also to show what is impacting this particular character at this particular time, right? So once I've done all that, I kind of look at it as the architecture of my story. It's the foundation, the pillars, the roof that I'm anchoring my tale. But there's always going to be that little gap where I know what might have happened on an event that happened on a particular date at a particular time, but I don't know the conversation that took place. I don't know what was going through the character's mind, unless she journaled it, in which case I'll definitely include it. So just as an example, I know the date that that passage we just read, right? I know the date that Fritz and Hetty got married, and I know where it took place, and I know who was there, and I know what dress she wore, but I don't know the conversation she had with her father as she's about to walk down that aisle. Right, I don't know. But based on what I do know, and based on the documents that I've read, and that little tiny remnant of lawyerly logic that remains, I think I can extrapolate and create a scene. And that's really where the fiction comes in. And I hope it allows me to round out the tale in a more fulsome way than I might otherwise have. Now, of course, there's things that I don't know, right? And there are things, important things, that I have to include in the story, but I don't have the answer to the question. And I will never go directly against a historical fact that I've learned, but where there's an opening, where there's uncertainty, is also where fiction might come in. So one example would be in the book, Hetty adopts a young boy, Jamesy, and she calls him Jamesy. And we don't know anything about why she adopted him. And there's so much controversy, even today, over who this child was, why she adopted him, was he really her own child? And I couldn't find an answer. There is no answer, really. And as I was researching adoption at this time to try and get a sense of how unusual it was that she had adopted when she was a young woman in her 20s, I learned about the work of two other historical women, Frances Perkins, who was Secretary of Labor under the president, and Kate Rosenheim, who was the Nazi head of the Children's Welfare Unit. And they were working together to save Jewish children, secretly bringing them into the United States and having them adopted to American families. And I thought this was unbelievable. I never heard of this work. They crossed enemy lines to do it. And this was happening right at the same time that Hetty adopted Jamesy. And I just couldn't help but think to myself, here's a woman, a Jewish refugee herself, riddled with guilt over the fact that she left Austria knowing what was going to happen to the Jewish people and only got herself out. If she was presented with a young child to adopt, wouldn't it be possible that she would take him in? Now, that's total fiction. I have no proof for that ever occurred. But I wanted to highlight the work that these women had did, and it fit my story. And so that was a work completely of fiction, inserted into what I hope is otherwise a relatively realistic historical narrative.
And for me, that works because you've already
yes.
talked about it being historical fiction. You know that there are parts that are contextually possible contextually have to have happened. The reporter in me and the editor in me wants to go, no, no, we have to know. But you don't really have to know everything, because you're writing about a woman's heart and about her soul and about this journey rather than a ticker tape. It's not a news article.
No.
So, but do you get any pushback from people who want more? Like, okay, well, if you don't know for sure, then what else can you tell us? Or where's the rest of the story?
Oh, all the time. And I constantly get emails where people have corrected me. Not my favorite thing to get, but it happens. People always want to know what's fact and what's fiction. And it's, to me, the greatest compliment when someone else has gone down the rabbit hole where I live and checked out some of the facts. Please fact check me. I love it. Because I'm going to learn something new, too. But I love, that's such a compliment when someone is intrigued enough by the story that they're going to learn more and they're going to dig deeper. And I usually do include in the back, in the author's note, a list of nonfiction research material compilations that you can use to do that, which I would definitely recommend over Wikipedia, although Wikipedia does serve its purpose, right? So, you know, I think for me, it's that is a big part of it. That is. But part of it, too, is just kind of making sure that while I satisfy my own kind of maniacal sense of historical accuracy and research, and that I've unturned every stone, that when I can't, I'm going to fill it in with the most logical explanation that I can come with that still fits the arc of my story.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Rochelle Riley's conversation with Marie Benedict.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Rochelle Riley's conversation with Marie Benedict.
When you finish something like The Other Einstein, or you found a character like that, how do you pick the next character? What drew you to Hedy Lamarr?
Oh, wow. It's such a hard
Because you could have
question.
Gone, several places, but this particular time for this particular thing, particularly when we have no privacy and...
Right.
The internet is the talk of the town every day.
Right. Well, I keep it's like a Santa Claus list of women that I would love to write about. As I mentioned, I find them everywhere. They're everywhere. And people always come to me with their own ideas, too, which I love. And I've often considered a lot of those. So when I was writing The Other Einstein, or when I was finishing up Carnegie's Maid, I had on my list... a woman that a dear friend of mine who's an anthropologist had mentioned. She had mentioned this golden age of Hollywood actress who had made an invention, right? And I had put her on my list, and I kind of was, this is what I do as I kind of am finishing up a book, I'm circling back to the next idea, thinking about what I want to write next. And when I kind of dug into Hedy's story, and I learned that that invention that my friend had mentioned wasn't just revolutionary, which it was. I mean, it's hard to overestimate how innovative her secret communication system was. This innovation she was going to superimpose on torpedo systems to make them radio controlled, which nobody had been able to figure out how to do. Nobody except Hedy Lamarr.
Girl power.
Woo! I mean, if it had been adopted, there's a decent chance it could have really changed the war landscape at sea, but it wasn't. But when I learned, not only was this just incredible, right, that she had made this this invention, I learned the legacy of it, and that every day we hold and utilize a piece of her legacy, whether it's in our cell phones or our Bluetooth headphones, any wireless device we use really stems from that original patent that she created for her secret communication system for torpedoes. I knew that hers was a story I had to tell because it really shows so pointedly how her legacy lives with us every day and how we have no idea that it's there. It's hard to come up with a more tangible piece of evidence for women's impact and women's unknown impact. So when all of those things kind of coalesced, I knew hers was the story I had to tell next. But there are so many.
Can you imagine if you asked somebody, oh God, who invented the GPS? I don't know the guy. Or... do you know anything about
telephone?
The history of Wi-Fi? And there's like a whole list. It's like, oh, I'll have to look him up. And
right.
They'd be wrong every time.
Every time. And I love that. So, I just to digress for 1 second,
sure.
Too. You know, and it kind of goes to what you're saying about just assuming that it's, well, like we do, it's a man. Mm-hmm. Part of me that wanted to write this book as well because of my own reaction to the story when my friend first said, Golden Age of Hollywood actress, also an inventor. I remember feeling surprised, right, that this beautiful woman could have invented this incredibly groundbreaking device. And I was angry at myself for feeling that way. And I think most people who I tell the story to, they're like, really? She was both brilliant and beautiful? And you know, and here I am, I write women's historical stories. Like, but, you know, it's so ingrained in each of us is this reaction, especially when we're looking at historical women who, you know, whose lives and whose opportunities have been much more conscripted than modern day women. But even still, I was really chastising myself for even thinking that. And I wanted to explore that feeling. I wanted to explore what Hetty must have faced on a regular basis, being so smart, so brilliant, and constantly having to suppress that part of herself because no one could believe that both of those things could coexist. And I thought, you know, that is a historic problem, but even for my reaction to my friend telling me her story that first time, it's a modern day problem too. So, you know, it was definitely in part the invention, but also in part it was my own sort of visceral reaction to that story.
I'm glad you said that because I was going to say that next, literally. I'm not a fan of hidden figures. I don't mean just the movie, but just in general, that all of a sudden we are just hearing the stories of these people, but particularly women, who did amazing things and we didn't know. Katherine Johnson is like nearing 100 years old, and I'm like, yeah, we're celebrating her now, but she got no celebration when she was actually doing this. And when I got the book, I was embarrassed. And then I was angry. I said, how did I, because you know, journalists know everything. We absolutely know everything. We must know everything. I said, how did I not know this? Because I knew the name Hedy Lamarr. I knew the actress. I never knew this. I was really embarrassed and then really mad at myself.
And did you struggle at all with that feeling like, how could this be true? Like this sense that this was an incredible story, not incredible in the sense that she rose up and made this unbelievable invention, but that these two things could not coexist together, that we have this instinctive reaction to that.
I love when we switch roles,
sorry,
and play interviewer and interviewee.
Ask her some questions.
But really, I want to answer that because here was the thing. I didn't even get to that point about the beauty and the brains.
Mm.
I was just mad that this was hidden, that this was not something that people knew in 2019.
Right.
It's bad enough that it just wasn't known, period, and that she had to hide it. But I thought, this should at least be mentioned in a history class, or somebody should have said something about this. That got me. And then, of course, she was beautiful, and then I got just jealous.
Like, well, there's that.
God, so she does all of this stuff, and she was gorgeous.
She's got it all.
She's got it all.
But you know what's interesting about what you just said is, and I, one of the greatest things, you know, because writing is such a solitary profession.
Yes.
So for me to come out to get to talk to people and then get their feedback afterwards, I have met all over the country so many people who knew Hedy Lamarr, knew her children, were her caretakers. But I've also had the opportunity to meet so many women in this field who said that Hetty's contribution to Wi-Fi, to all the patent that's at the core of this, has always been known in those circles. The people, they're like, oh, that's Hetty's patent. That's actually how it's referred to in the fields in which this patent is utilized. And when I learned that, and I did a little research, and I realized that that was true, what's more frustrating is that there was some awareness of it, and yet it still wasn't brought to the forefront. Not until the very end of Hetty's life. She died in her 80s, and I was told by her caretakers who came to an event I did in Florida, which was such a gift, that in the very end of her life, she started to get a few awards. Not big awards, but some recognition for the role that she had played. And that meant more to her than any movie she'd ever participated in. And I just, you know, to hear that, to learn that she did have some sense of the recognition that she could receive for that was really, really amazing to hear. So I felt very fortunate that they came.
Oh, I got chills with that. Yeah. You mentioned Jamesy. So what I'd like to do is end our portion of this wonderful evening by having you read something that moved me to tears. Because as women, you know, well, not for me, because I'm not a wife, although I'm still looking. But but when we have to juggle all of those things we do as mothers, as wives, and then as whatever it was we were meant to be in addition to those things, nobody else knows what that's like. And there's a passage in the book that I'd like for our audience to hear you read, because I think it's the perfect place for us to end.
Thank you.
Here you are.
The chance to adopt the refugee child wasn't one Jean had jumped at. Nor, if I were truthful with myself, had I. I'd felt compelled to pick up that piece of paper off the table at the Brown Derby. My compulsion stemmed not out of maternal longing. My own upbringing was bereft of warm motherly role models, but stemmed from a sense of guilt and my subsequent inaction. Perhaps, I thought to myself, if I saved this child, it would serve as penance for all the others I didn't save. I'd never explained to Jean about Jamesy's likely heritage or the circumstances behind his adoption, but then he had no idea about my own Jewishness either. Would the truth have made him feel more connected to me, more attached to Jamesy? What did Jean understand about the adoption was that it was a possible means of knitting us together. His very willingness to move forward with the adoption for me, even when he already had a daughter of his own, made me feel closer to him. And when I held Jamesy in my arms, I gazed at Jean with a sense of completeness. But when bringing a baby into our home didn't yield the close family unit for which I'd hoped, but instead the usual two separate lives, the reality of our alienation became inescapable. I read Jean's words. I heartened a little at the list of qualities he admired, my European charm, my beauty, my skills as a homemaker and mother, and my intellect. Glancing up at Jean, I gave him a small smile that he didn't see. He was lost in my words. Then I braced myself for the list of my flaws that surely he must have written. But the list was blank. My brows knitted, and I looked up from the page into Jean's waiting eyes. You didn't list any problems, I mentioned. No, he said. Why? Because they're not your problems, Hetty. They're not your flaws. The problem between us lies with me. What do you mean? Jean's eyes grew soft, almost sad. You married me hoping for something entirely reasonable, Hetty. A husband, a home, a family. But what you want, I can't give to you. I don't have it in me to be parent to another child. Not now, anyway. I nodded, understanding, at last. This marriage to Jean would never improve, never progress. It was over. Jean braved the silence, saying what both of us thought but neither wanted to say first. Shall we meet with a lawyer? I nodded. There was really no other way. What about Jamesy? Jean asked, tilting his head toward the sleeping baby. What was he asking? Was he asking who would get custody? Or was he asking the unthinkable, whether we would return him? I lifted my son from the bassinet and squeezed him close. Jamesy squealed a little but didn't waken. I will keep him, I said, knowing that Mrs. Burton, Jamesy's nanny, would spend far more time with him than me because of my work demands. Still, I supposed, his life in America was far better than the fate he left behind in Europe. Jean nodded, reaching out to touch my free hand gently. I'd still like to see him from time to time. Of course, Jean. You're his father, after all. Whatever role you'd like to play. I'd clung to Jean as a safe haven, a version of Papa that he couldn't possibly fulfill, and he'd married the glamorous movie star who partied nightly. But I was only simple Hetty Kiesler, and he was a Hollywood bon vivant. I carried a heavy secret for which I needed to atone, and Jean sought the light, shunning even the hint of darkness. We were opposite, and we were strangers.
Wow.
Kind of dark eyes.
No, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Heather Marie Benedict Terrell.
Thank you. Thank you. You are fabulous.
I want to thank the National Writers Series for doing this amazing work. Thank them for having me back for a second year in a row to have two amazing experiences. And ladies and gentlemen, Marie Benedict.
Thank you. And thank you to Rochelle
Riley. The only woman in the room.
Wow, how lucky am I? Thank you.
That was Marie Benedict talking with Rochelle Riley. Marie Benedict's latest novel is called The Only Woman in the Room. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerrick.